we turn once again to the book of Revelation and we come to the sixth chapter. In the book of Revelation, we have indicated on a number of occasions, we're not going to go through the book of Revelation exhaustively, but we do hope to make some comments on every chapter, just to remind ourselves of this, the most glorious epistle of the entire New Testament, the clearest prophecy in the whole of the Bible concerning things that are going to come to pass. There is nothing quite like the book of Revelation in the whole of the Bible. It stands apart. It is, in many ways, as more than one commentator has put it, it is the icing on the cake. It doesn't introduce new doctrine. It clarifies old doctrine and brings together a whole series of strands of biblical promises and prophecies in such a manner that we might have hope and understand the times in which we live and the times that are yet to come in the experience of God's people. So that is what the book of Revelation is all about. It is a prophecy from Jesus Christ concerning Jesus Christ, and it is given to us in signs. It is signified to us, as we are told in the opening verse of the book of Revelation. Well, we have looked at the first five chapters in brief outline. We finished off last time making some comment concerning the praise of the Lamb, worthy is the Lamb who was slain, chapter 5 at verse 12. And we did make the point that when we came to chapter 4 through to chapter 7, we are dealing with the second section in the book of Revelation. The book is divided into seven sections, and the first three chapters dealing with the seven churches is the first section, covering the entire dispensation from the first coming to the second coming of Christ. And likewise, in each of the subsequent sections, every one of these seven sections deals with the first to the second coming of Jesus Christ. But with each successive section, we are led a little bit more into the future. Each section adds something more concerning the glory to come, until finally in the last section we have a clear picture of a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. The second section of the book, chapters 4, 5, 6, and 7, deals with the seven seals, and we made mention last Wednesday, you remember, of the little book, or the book that was sitting on the hand of him who sat upon the throne, sealed with seven seals, and only the Lamb, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, was mighty enough to win a victory which entitled him to open the book and to reveal to God's people, and indeed to the world if they care to read, but to God's people he reveals the contents of the book. Now in chapter 6 we have the opening of the first six of these seals, and the seventh seal is not opened until the opening of chapter 8, and the seventh seal, when it is opened, leads us into the next section of the book from chapter 8 to 11, which deals with the seven trumpets of judgment. So these sections merge one into the other, but they are not successive chronologically in history. They are each one going back to the beginning of the Christian era and climaxing at the end of the Christian age. Now this chapter 6 in Revelation covers the entire history of the Christian period. The opening of the seals, the opening of the first one till the opening of the sixth seal, which takes us evidently to the day of judgment. So there is no question that from verse number 13 onwards, from verse 12 onwards in chapter 6, we have arrived at the end of the age. We have arrived there because we know we've come to the day of judgment. And we're told that in the section. And indeed, we're going to be concentrating our thoughts this evening on the day of judgment, with a particular emphasis that is being made here, and that is the day, the great day of his wrath. And so our thoughts this evening are going to be lingering mainly around the final few verses of chapter 6. If we read from verse 15, for example, the kings of the earth and the great men and the rich men and the chief captains and the mighty men, and every bondman and every free man hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? And if we were going to take a single text or a single title for our topic this evening, it would undoubtedly have to be "The Great Day of His Wrath Has Come," the very last verse of the chapter. But we're going to lead into this great statement, and we're going to look at the chapter as a whole, almost by way of introduction to the great day of his wrath, which has come, and who is going to be able to stand in that day. So that is the theme that we want to look at. And the first thing that we have to emphasize then, in the light of this coming great day of the wrath of God, is when is it that this day is going to come? And we're actually told in this chapter when it is going to come. It is going to come when the sixth seal is opened. And the sixth seal is opened only after the previous five seals are opened. And so this chapter broadly can be divided into three main sections. Verses 1 to 8 deal with the opening of the first four seals, where we have the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as it is popularly spoken of. And you find that many people, even in poetry and in secular literature, will write in terms of the imagery of Revelation chapter 6, the opening eight verses, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. It's a well-known imagery in the world of our day. And then from verse 9 to 11, we have this vision of the souls of those who are under the altar, those who have been slain. And they are asking the Lord, how long must it be before finally he rises up to avenge their blood that has been shed upon the earth? And they are given a reply and a purpose. They are given white robes, and they are told to rest in peace, because the day is going to come when they are going to be avenged. And they are being reminded that other Christian believers also are going to have to be slain, as they already have been slain. So in these verses 9 to 11, we are being reminded immediately that the afflictions that come to God's people in this world are not accidental. In verse 11, white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season, what seems to us to be a great delay and a long period of time between the first and the second comings of Christ, is in the Lord's estimate of time and events, it is only a little season. It is not long before Christ will come, according to God's purpose and plan. And we must rest content with God's promise and his control of this little period of time between the first and the second comings of the Savior. And they're to rest for a little season, until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were. It is God's purpose that many more of his own people in the world should be killed for the name and the testimony of Jesus Christ. And we're going to see later on in the book of Revelation how this inevitably works out. God has a plan for his people to wipe away all the tears from their eyes, as we're going to see next time. And as the Puritans used to say, woe betide the man or the woman who has no tears for God to wipe away. God's people in this world are a weeping people. And there are burdens upon our hearts of which the world can never begin even to understand or to experience. And then the final section of this chapter, the final third section, is of course from verse 12, the sixth seal. So we have the first four seals as a piece, then we have the fifth seal, and then we have the sixth seal. And then we have come to the last day and to the great judgment. So when we ask the question, when is the great day of his wrath coming? It is going to come after certain appointed things have been accomplished. We've already seen, you remember last time, how the book contains a completed purpose. Nothing is left to chance. There are no gaps. There are no, as it were, omissions. There is nothing needed to be added. Nothing can be taken away. God's plan is already in place. He knows the end from the beginning. And these things will happen. And that is going to include suffering and disappointment, inconsistency, the rejoicing of the world, the apparent defeat of Christianity, the apparent victory of humanism and secularism, and it is all according to God's mysterious purpose of grace for his people. So we're going to begin by trying to answer the question, when is the day, by looking first of all at these first four seals being opened, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And you notice that the first seal is the opening up of the seal. Christ is opening the seals. And the first seal reveals to us a white horse and one sitting upon the white horse. Now, each of these seals reveals a horse of a different color. There is white, there is red, there's black, and there's a pale horse. The word in the Greek is chlorine, a kind of a pale, greeny color, a pale, sort of sickly, almost gangrenous-looking color. That's the idea that we have. And so we have each of these first four seals symbolizing a horse. Now, the imagery of the horse is very obvious. It's a symbol of strength and power. And there are those who quite rightly emphasize that what we have here are powerful movements in the history of the world. And they are being unleashed down through the history of the world. But what do these things mean? Now, the second, third, and fourth seals are fairly obvious. We're told that the second seal is red, and a power was given that they should kill one another. Here is a picture of bloodletting, bloodthirstiness. It is a picture of war and mutual destruction. So here we are being reminded that in the world and towards the Christian church, there is going to be antagonism. There is going to be bloodthirsty bloodletting. The symbolism is of a red power of wrath and antagonism against the church. And then there is this blackness, this black horse, or this dark horse. And this symbolizes trouble, poverty, injustice, the unfair balances, poverty coming to God's people, and so on. In the world, there is going to be tribulation. That is what this picture is all about. And the fourth seal, representing this pale horse, represents the power of death. Death comes in the end. Life is hard, and then you die. And that is the way. And Hades follows. That's the condition of death. And so the second, the third, and the fourth seals are fairly obvious because they are self-explanatory. But it is the first seal that causes the difficulty and the differences of opinion among the scholars. Because there are two diametrically opposed views as to exactly who is it that is sitting upon the white horse. I saw and behold a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him. He went forth conquering and to conquer, and so on. And there are those, the two views, there are those who take the view that here is a picture of Jesus Christ going forth in his conquering gospel to spread the gospel to the ends of the earth. But there are those who say that this is not Christ. Because just as the second, the third, and the fourth seals speak of antagonism, cruelty, and bloodshedding, and that kind of thing, injustice, so in order to fit into the picture of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the first horse, even although he is colored white, must also include the idea of injustice, unrighteousness, and so on. And so there are those good scholars, and many of them are very eminent scholars, let me tell you, and they take the view that what we have here is the false church going forth, that what we have here is Antichrist. And one of the great successful ploys of the Antichrist, as we're going to see later on in the book of Revelation, is that he is so like the real thing. Counterfeit money can pass easily. It is only detected by those who are experts. And it's the same in the art market. There are marvelously skillful forgers who can copy well-known paintings, and it takes a real art expert to know the difference between the original, authentic painting and the imitation, which is so well done. And there is no question that there is a great deal of false religion in the church, as in the world, which seems very like the gospel. And so there are those who maintain that what we have in the first seal being opened is in fact the Antichrist going forth. And when the Antichrist goes forth, he causes wars, he causes trouble for the church, and in the end he brings death in his train. That is one argument. Now there are good men who take that view, and they buttress their view on what they would consider good arguments. I do not agree with that view. I agree with those scholars who maintain that what we have here in the first white horse is in fact Christ going forward. This color white occurs 16 times in the book of Revelation, and in every other single place where it occurs, without exception, it always refers to purity and to righteousness. Indeed, in verse number 11 of this same chapter, we're told white robes were given unto every one of them. And in the seventh chapter, you remember, we are told of the great multitude. They are clothed in white robes. And there are other references. In the 19th chapter, there is the picture there, you remember, of Christ coming on the white horse. The color white in the Bible is the symbol of purity. And what I'm emphasizing, and I believe it is the correct interpretation, is that when Christ begins to open the book with the seven seals, the very first thing that he is reminding his people is that the gospel is going to go forth. Despite all the appearances down through the ages to the contrary, the gospel is, in fact, still a conquering power. And Christ is on the white horse. He is in the world. And he is going to achieve God's purpose in the gospel. This fits in perfectly well with what Christ has told us in Matthew chapter 24, you remember, when the disciples asked him, what are the things that are going to take place before the end comes and before you come again? And you remember the great promise that he gave to his people, that this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world before the end comes. There will be opposition to the gospel, but all the opposition of the world, whatever form it takes, cannot destroy the ancient power of the gospel. It remains forever until the end of time. It remains the power of God unto salvation. And it is God's plan that the world may think or do what it will. It cannot stop the gospel going forth. And we're going to see how this is worked out in the 20th chapter, when Satan, in fact, is bound for the whole of the Christian era, and he is bound in such a way that he cannot deceive the nations against the gospel. He is let loose again. But during the Christian dispensation, when the gospel is to be preached in the world, it is an irresistible power. And it may seem small at times, it may decline, it may actually die out in some parts of the world for some time, but that does not negate the basic principle that the gospel is the power of God and it will go forth. And so the very first thing that God purposes to do in the opening of the seals, he is reminding us that his first main purpose is to spread the gospel. And so in the white horse we do have the going forth of the gospel, conquering and to conquer. And what happens in the red and the black and the pale horse is simply a picture of the ongoing resistance to the gospel. What happens when the gospel goes forth? There is a disturbance. He brings not peace upon the earth, but he brings a sword. Wherever the gospel goes forth, in a real sense, all hell breaks loose. And it is sometimes a good sign for a Christian to be troubled. It is sometimes a good sign for a Christian congregation to be troubled for righteousness' sake, because that means that we must be doing something right. Otherwise, the devil, quite frankly, would leave us sleeping in our religious torpors. And when you find that there is opposition rising up, within a congregation or outside it, that means something is being done right in that congregation. And that is the picture that we have of these other three horses: red, bloodshed, injustice, and in the end, destruction even unto death and sickness. That's the picture. So I put to you, that is the significance of these first four horsemen of the apocalypse. That's the first, the second, and the third, and the fourth seals being opened. The fifth seal, we've already commented on it. That's the souls of believers. They are already in glory. They are under the altar. They were slain. These are the martyrs. And they were put to death for the testimony to the testimony which they held. And they are safe under God's altar. They are secure there. They know what is taking place on earth. They don't know as yet all God's purpose for his people upon the earth. And so they inquire of the Lord, how much longer is this going to go on? God's saints slaughtered mercilessly upon the earth. And they are told there's more to come. You just rest. They were given white robes, and that speaks of their righteousness and their security. So everything is in the control of God. And so here we have a picture of the events in the history of our world leading up to the great day of judgment. Now, there are many things we could say about this final picture that we have here in the opening of the sixth seal, the picture of the great day of judgment. But it is interesting that this is not just judgment generally that is being spoken of. It is judgment in terms of the wrath of God and of the Lamb. This is a picture not just of judgment of the saints of God. This is a picture of the judgment of the enemies of God. Those who have resisted the gospel, those who have put to death God's people upon the earth, they are now being brought forward to judgment, not by the church. They are being brought forward to judgment by God on that day. Now, there are six classes of men mentioned who come up for judgment. There are six objects mentioned here which are affected by the judgment. But the main theme running through it all is that that day, for the ungodly opponents of the gospel, is not a day of pleasantness. It is not a day of blessing. It is a day of wrath. And so what we have here is that this is the wrath of God. And we've got to understand this biblical doctrine of the wrath of God. Because if there is any theme that we find consistently running through the Bible, it is the reality of the wrath of God. And the wrath of God is spoken of, first of all, in Genesis chapter 2. You remember, the day that you eat thereof, you are going to die. Already there, our first parents in the Garden of Eden were being warned there is such a thing as the wrath of God. And the wrath of God is revealed against all disobedience. The moment his moral creatures disobey, they are subject to death. Death is not some kind of biological inevitability, not according to the Bible, at least not for moral creatures it's not. It is a divine penalty for sin imposed by a judge. And when the Bible speaks of the wrath of God, it's not some kind of picture that you and I have sometimes coming into our mind. The wrath of man, James reminds us, does not work the righteousness of God. But the wrath of God works the righteousness of God, because the wrath of God is not the same as your wrath and my wrath. Sometimes our wrath takes the aspect of pure malice, where we just hate people and we deal with them unjustly. We punish them more, perhaps, than they ought to be punished. Or if we have a certain lenient mood, or we happen to be related to them by blood or some kind of thing, or maybe if they share our same club, we might let them off lightly. That happens all the time in human justice. There's no real human justice possible in this present world, because we are all flawed creatures. Only God knows every aspect of every single life and every case. Only he knows what penalty deserves what crime. Only he is able to understand who did what and who didn't do what. And that is why we are being reminded in quite a number of places in the Bible not to be over much judgmental and to assume that we know the motives why people do things, when in fact we may not know the motives at all why people do things. There may be motives that are known only to God. And it is going to take the day which will reveal all secrets, ultimately to reveal just who did what and why. And that is why when we come to another judgment scene in the 20th chapter in the book of Revelation, we are told the judgment comes out of books being opened. And what are these books being opened? These are the books of the things that every human life has done. And God knows what's in these books. Many of these things we have long forgotten. It's like looking through an old family album of pictures that we had long forgotten. We didn't even remember being there or being in that company on that occasion. And then suddenly we come across these old photographs and we suddenly remember, oh yes, I can remember what it was like then and there. We had forgotten about it. We didn't even know. And if someone had asked us if we'd ever met the person, we would have sworn in a court of law, I never met the man before. And sometimes it takes evidence that brings us back to our memory, you see. Now, this is the picture that the Bible has. Sins that you and I forget so easily, and we urge other people to forget. Sins that we willingly forget. And the great men and all these kings of the earth and so on, they go their merry way and they're creating mayhem. And they never seem to stop to consider the possibility there's a day of reckoning for them. And this is what this picture is all about. And so the wrath of God is something that is spoken of. The Apostle Paul speaks of it in Romans chapter 1. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all the unrighteousness and the wickedness and the unrighteousness of men who hold down the truth in unrighteousness. Men are judged as morally responsible for the simple reason that we ought not to do the wicked things that we do, because we know perfectly well that what we're doing is wrong. And God will assess exactly what the degree of guilt is and apportion blame and penalty accordingly. The wrath of God is not a spasmodic, sudden, unreasonable, malicious attitude where he is out of control, as sometimes we are. There are some people in this world, and we say they've got a short fuse. Some people can be very, very patient. Some people shoot from the hip, and they should think before they speak. And it's just the way we are. But God is not like that. He takes every conceivable aspect into consideration. And some people who may well do the same thing exactly may be treated differently because their circumstances might indeed be different. A man who steals a loaf of bread because he's hungry deserves a lesser punishment, I would argue, than a man who steals a loaf of bread because he's a kleptomaniac. And he doesn't need the loaf of bread. You see, the same act has to be judged. And so it's not simply a matter of what we do, it's why we do it. And what are the advantages or disadvantages that we have lived our lives under. And all that kind of thing is taken into consideration. And so here we have a picture of the wrath of God. And Jesus Christ, our Lord, he spoke of the day of wrath also. And here we have the response of those who are up for judgment. They're not ignorant. There's no plea of innocence or ignorance. I didn't know, Your Honor. Everybody who stands before him in judgment knows who they are. There's equality. They know why they're there. They know what the issues are. Because deep down in their conscience, as Paul reminds us in Romans chapter 2, each man's conscience is going to rise up in that day. And our conscience will excuse us or accuse us in that day when God judges the secrets of men by Jesus Christ. So this is the general picture that is being presented to us here. The great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? Now, there is an alternative rendering of this last verse. Some of the translations have not the great day of his wrath, but the great day of their wrath. Because who is it that is performing the judgment on this great day of wrath? Well, we're told in verse number 16, these condemned men, the mighty ones of the earth, who never gave Christ a second glance or thought, They now cry to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath is come. Whose wrath is being revealed from the throne of God? It is him who sits upon it, but also the wrath of the Lamb. And this is the astonishing and ultimately frightening thing. C.S. Lewis, commenting on this, has this to say. That face, he says, the face of Jesus Christ, which is either the delight or the terror of the universe, is going to look at us all that day, and we're going to be looking into the face of God's Lamb, and we're going to be looking into the face of the Savior of the world, and if we are saved sinners, we are going to be looking, and that face is going to be a delight to us to behold him. But if in fact we have spurned and scorned him, that face, which is a delight to his people, is a terror to the universe of evil men, the wrath of the Lamb. It's almost incongruous, a lamb. You don't normally associate wrath and anger and ferocious wrath with a lamb. But that is what we are being told here. All judgment is given to the Son. Many will say to me in that day, I will raise him up. The Son of Man will come in the throne of his glory, and before him, the one who casts sinners into hell is exactly the same one who receives sinners into heaven. It is the one individual Savior judge. One or the other is the possible relationship that we bear to him and he to us. And if he will not save us, then he will judge us. But we will face him one way or the other. We will appear before him. And this is what is being spoken of in this day of wrath, the final day when every account will be settled, every sin will be revealed for the evil thing that it is, and justice at long last in God's universe is going to be done. But notice also how this day of wrath is described. It is described as the great day of his wrath is now come. Why do you think it is described as the great day? This is not the only place, by the way, in the New Testament where the day of God is described as the great day. Jude speaks of it. The great day. We'll give account in that great day, and so on. It is great not because it is of extraordinary length. It's not a question of duration as such. And I'm saying that because when you think of what is going to transpire on this day, there is a tremendous amount of activity going to take place because every single individual is going to be judged in that day. But I don't think it is the actual duration of this day that makes it so great. I think it is the importance of it, the significance of it, the sheer magnitude of the issues that are raised, and the multitude of the people who are going to be assembled all together in that day. Because this day is quite unlike any other day in the entire history of God's universe. It is the only day, as far as I know, in which every single human being is going to be gathered together before the separation comes. Jesus speaks of that in Matthew 25, before him shall be gathered all the nations, all together. And then in some way a final separation begins to take place. But before the separation, there is the commonality of humanity brought up for judgment. And as far as I know, there is never going to be a day in the entire history of the world where every human being is going to be in the same place at the same time. Everybody who has ever lived and is ever going to live in the future is present on this day. I remember reading once that someone was estimating how many people do you think have ever lived in the history of our world? There are different answers given to that. But even some who are inclined to the creation point of view of a fairly recent creation would say that on present demographic growth, the world's population, of course, has doubled in the last 60 years. Before the 1800s, it was probably less than 1,000 million. It's now nearly 7,000 million people. And the growth is just about up. It's almost a vertical growth. We are living in a world increasingly where, quite frankly, it seems there are going to be too many people if it continues. The world can't sustain it. But the point is, how many? According to this book that I was reading, he recognized that even in a fairly recent period, probably not more than 60 billion people, say roughly 10 times the population of the present world. Now, I'm not going to say that man was right or wrong. I'm simply saying that he had studied the matter, came to a certain conclusion, and said, well, this would probably be the figure. And sometimes you wonder why. The question is not why is the population of the world so big, but why is it so small? If, in fact, we have been populating the world for the millions of years that we are supposed to, why are there so few of us upon the earth? Why is there so much unused space? That's another consideration, but we don't have time to go into it. But here is a great day where there's a great multitude. And this is a multitude beyond our computation. Everybody that is ever going to be a human being is present. It's great in that sense. But the issues are great. The joy of some of these people is going to be greater than they've ever known. The sorrow of multitudes on this day is going to be greater than they have ever known. You see, when people die, they either go to heaven or to hell, but that's not the end. Sometimes theologians speak of the intermediate state. I think that's a bad description. I know it's well used, but it's not one that the Bible uses, actually. The Bible speaks of our life not in three phases, but in two phases, the present and the future. And when you and I die, we go into the future. We go into either eternity in glory or eternity in a lost condition. But that's not the end. There's more to come. When you and I die and go into heaven, that's not the last word. There's the judgment to come. And there's going to be a greater heaven. And for those who are lost, they go into a place where there is evidently pain and suffering. But that's only a foretaste of more to come. So the best way, the biblical way of understanding the future is divided into two parts. The immediate after death, and then the future, the finalized future after the judgment. And I think that is a more biblical way to view. So here is a company of everybody who's ever lived. Many of them have died and gone into that place, Hades. They already know they're lost. But why are they now terrified before him? They're lost, yes, because there's more loss to come. There's worse to come. You see, eternity is not just a spiritual, it's also a physical experience. It's the body that's going to rise, that's going to go into one place or the other. The issues are great. The joy is great for the saints of God. This is the day when they will know exactly what it means to be a saved creature. And great will be their joy in that day, and great will be the sorrow of those who are lost on that day. Oh, if only there was a place to flee. If only mountains or rocks could cover us, make us invisible. Don't let him see us anymore. We can't stand. Who shall be able to stand? And so our final consideration this evening, very briefly, is who is able to stand? That's a question that the Bible asks. Psalm 15 asks that question. Who will stand in God's temple? Psalm 24 asks the same question. Psalm 130 asks the same question. If thou should mark iniquity, who could stand? The Bible answers that question for us. In the very next chapter, in Revelation chapter 7, at verse 9, after this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne. Who shall stand? Those who are clothed with white robes will stand. Those who have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb, they shall stand in that day. They shall stand. And the issue for you and for me is, where do we stand now? You see, since Christ has come into the world, the issue is not a matter of what do we think of God. That's not the question that the New Testament poses. The question that the New Testament is interested in, what do we think of Christ? The Muslim believes in God. Hindus believe in God. People who never darken the place of any place of worship of any kind, they believe in God. Most people in the world tonight probably do believe in God of some kind. And most of them probably have a fairly accurate view of what God might be like. That's not the issue. The issue is, what do we think of Christ? And you and I will only stand in that day insofar as we think right of him. And that means that we think of him as he is revealed in the gospel, and we receive him and follow him as he is revealed in the gospel. What think ye of Christ? If we think well of him now, he will think well of us then, and we will think well of him then too. That's the picture, you see. The whole Christian era is brought before our purview in Revelation chapter 6. And everything that happens has already been determined in God's book of destiny. And that is comfort. And that is our glorious future. According to his promises, we look for a new heaven and a new earth. May God bless his word to us.